So, Bill, I read something that you said last night, and it absolutely blew my mind because I wanted to come in and disprove this. And it was something that you noted from National Research Council data. And it says any new idea by the time it reaches maturity takes 20 years.
At least.
And I was just fascinated by that because I thought, well, you know, Moore's Law, the coming singularity, all these other things, there has to get faster than that over time. But everything that I looked at proved it right. And I'll show you one example. This was, 1991 compared to the big hype today with the Oculus Rift and
Yeah.
the treadmill that you run on the Omni.
Oh, by the way, you are so. You can go back another 20
Yeah.
years. Go to Ivan Sutherland.
Yeah, 91's not the right
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can go back
reference
to
for that.
71.
Yeah.
So the mouse took 30 years.
Yeah.
65 to Windows 95 before it was there. Heck, LCDs were identified in the late 1800s. Liquid crystals, the chemistry was understood because somebody was studying carrots, carotene, to study chlorophyll. And just found out there's this funny state where there's two liquid states and not one.
Yeah.
Depending on the temperature, it's cloudy versus transparent. And that got lost. But so here's the thing. A lot of people don't know the difference between voltage and amperage. And that's a good way to, by analogy, or fire hoses. A lot of things moving slowly gives the impression of rapid change, even though any individual thing's moving slowly. But the reason I think that's what I call the long nose of innovation, and the reason I think this is really important is to say it's a hockey stick too. And it takes 20 years from its first articulated publicly and knowable to anybody who chooses to stick their head below the radar. But most of it's below the radar, and then it's a hockey stick up, and maturity is when, say, it's a billion-dollar industry. Now, what's interesting about that is that it changes the nature of what we think invention and innovation are. And changes our complete thinking from some ideal model that never existed to what has always been the case.
Yeah.
And that is that every idea is based on some previous ideas rethought. And so here's the deal. It's fascinating. Any idea that's going to be a billion-dollar industry in 10 years is already 10 years old. Any idea that's going to be a billion-dollar industry in 5 years is already 15 years old. And by the way, it's still below the radar. And by the way, if you tell me that it's going to be really big and you cannot give me 15 years of history,
Yeah.
I don't believe you. Or you haven't done your homework, or you're the luckiest person in the world, and therefore it's like you're cashing in your 401k and buying a lottery ticket, and then because you win the lottery, you're an investment genius. No,
Yeah.
you're not. You're just lucky.
Yeah.
Okay? And you can't repeat it. You have to be able to repeat it.
Yeah.
So what that says is, innovation and creativity is far more about prospecting than being able to mine, then be able to refine. And then the ideal part, and this is where the best part is that taking that gold and through goldsmithing, make it worth even more than its weight in gold.
Yeah.
But that's a very different model. And if you look at anything Apple's done, if you look at anything Picasso did, you can look at anything that happens in architecture or in any, it's always, you can go back and trace if you're literate in the field. And if you look in art, music, theater, dance, cinema, architecture, anybody who calls himself a professional, who deserves to be called a professional, knows that history.
Yeah.
And they can look at anything that's happening now and give you the roots. And by the way, that's not a negative thing. Because when Keith Richards plays a riff, quotes Chuck Berry, he assumes you know Chuck Berry if you're a real fan,
Yeah.
and you're going to be fascinated. Why did he pick that riff? And why did he put it here? And what's he going to do with it now? Where's he going to go next? And he knows that what you think of him isn't how fast his fingers can fly,
Yeah.
but it's the answer he gives you to each of those questions. That's where the mastery comes in of musicianship. It's not how fast you can play, right? That's why these people can go like that a million times. That's theater. That's not music. And by the way, I'm not downplaying theater, it's just a different thing.
Yeah.
So, but in computer science, so-called information technology, you would assume that we're the most informed, and our history is only 50 years old, and we haven't got a clue. What people don't know, they sort of the iPhone, wonderful thing. Well, 2007, the iPhone. 1993, the world's first so-called smartphone was the thing called the Simon. Two buttons, the entire screen is a touch screen, icons, apps, all that sort of stuff. It was there. Oh,
Yeah.
by the way, Johnny Ive absolutely knew about that. He went to Apple at the time that Newton was there. He was hired to go and do the second generation Newton. He had to know about the Simon. And so there's this difference between the myth and the reality, and the difference in some sense between ripping off and riffing off, is whether you know your sources and you acknowledge them.
Yeah.
And for me, I have far more respect for people, and this is one of the things why Jeff has always had my respect, because he always given credit and cited where his, he's open about that because he wants people to understand the process. Now think about some poor student who thinks that, for example, Johnny Ive at Apple invented everything from scratch. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to reproduce that. Well, if Johnny Ive can't even do it, what hope does some poor klutz who's trying to do it, right? So just be real about it. Edison never invented all that stuff. He had a whole factory of things, but he was the Steve Jobs at his time. He was the first so-called inventor, but actually was the first businessman that I'm aware of in the United States that had a full-time PR person and had a whole staff to create the legacy and shape the legacy that he wanted the, his public persona to be. Mm-hmm. His lawyer wrote his first biography. Right? And so this, and that we all take it as that's the truth. These are heroes. Right? We live in this thing, you know, I'm glad Seattle won. You know, is it going to the Super Bowl and stuff like that? But it shows this epitome. We want heroes.
Yeah.
And I'd rather have normal people that do spectacular things than geniuses that we could never hope to be who do miracles.
Or you can't replicate.
And you can't replicate
them. Process. I mean, that can happen. There can be random people that do that. But I mean, I remember learning about Edison, and I think a lot of there's a myth about invention and a myth about that flash of inspiration. And actually last night we were just talking about, you know, there was a time in patent law where the test for novelty for a patent was whether it came in a flash of inspiration. That was literally law for a little while, and then it got shot down.
For good reason.
Of course. But you know, when I was taught about Edison's, like, oh, he came up with, and then I actually learned, and they just didn't teach it to you that way. But when you start doing your own research about the person, and then you realize how much of an army of a lab he actually invented, the first corporate research lab in essence, you know, and was a great business person, and had parallel sets of teams all trying lots of different things. First of all, that did shatter my romanticism about inventing, because it did, and a lot of things he did. There's a spectrum here, but he did tend more in the brute force side, which lost its elegance for me. And I do believe there's something that he could target a little bit more. And you know, there's good rational design versus just throwing darts at a board. Mm-hmm. But in any case, I think there's a persistent mythos about that flash of inspiration, that invention, that doesn't preclude any other work that was built up to that point. That's very dangerous, and especially nowadays when the field is so interesting now, because we were talking about this before, you know, hardware is so good, software tools are really good. There are a lot of other really good things happening that the modern approach now has to be not making some single breakthrough in any of those. It's actually how we're tying all those things together. Yeah. And that modern sense of innovation is not making another incremental contribution or much more difficult, a big disruptive innovation in each one of the subdomains, but actually the innovations now, how are we putting these together in a much more interesting way? That requires actually a new type of thinking and a new type of skill, where we've also tended to, just similar to the kind of flash of inspiration thing or the eureka moment, we've tended to train people to be narrow and deep along one discipline, to look for that further progress along that line. But that doesn't have as much of impact anymore as trying to actually be really good, and you have to be, because it's so easy to be pretty good at some of these fields, but do that in multiple disciplines and be able to combine them. It's very interdisciplinary now.
So then of course the challenge there is, right, there were times in the earlier times, it was just a miracle we could make this stuff work and hold together. Right. And that's not good enough anymore. Right.
Exactly.
You don't win. You used to, if your bridge didn't fall down, it was okay if your bridge fell down every once in a while, but at least you'd get across the river some of the time.
Yeah.
Just as your text editor crashed every 5 minutes and nobody cared because it was still better.
Yeah.
It's not enough. The bar's changed. And it's not enough that it just works and it's really elegant. And so, in some sense, it's important to be able to make things that are beautiful, elegant, work really well, and are really carefully put together, well-crafted. My view is, I'm not going to be impressed with that. That's your bloody job.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Get on with it and stop.
That's just
stop,
baseline.
That's baseline. That's entry. If you can't do that, get out of the business, right? And the challenge right now is actually the meta design. It's how do you design the ecosystem? What's the architecture of the ecosystem? How does this stuff work together? So by working together and having more stuff, it actually reduces complexity and increases value.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest challenge. Otherwise, we come into what?
Otherwise, you're adding complexity by having trivially assembled, you know, really good on their own pieces that actually have an N squared relationship with each other, and then it becomes...
The cumulative complexity of a bunch of simple things rapidly it goes beyond the ability of the human to cope with. Right?
Yeah.
It comes right back to this notion of what's the most important technology. And it comes right back now in terms of all of this. It comes back to what were we doing last night, the opening question, right? And so we went back beyond those things. These videos were for 82. So then we started to go back another 20 years to stuff that people like Burt Sutherland and Wes Clark and the pioneers that were a generation at least before me. And these are people who, many of whom I was lucky to get to know and so on and so forth. Some of who work at Microsoft, like people like Chuck Thacker and, you know, Gary Stark, whether and Butler Lampson and stuff like that. There was stuff going on then that if you look at it today, instead of being impressed about all these doodads that you see at CS and so on, you have to say, what the hell have we been doing for the last 20 years? And why are we only here? And it was funny, one of my colleagues that worked with me in Toronto, I was watching a video and I saw something I'd completely forgotten, where he was working, he had a Sumo Graphics puck on the tablet, and he wanted to erase something, so he just had this gesture where you pick the puck up and you shake it. Now, there was no accelerometer in there. There was nothing. All he was doing was coming in out of range because there was hover on the from the antennas on the puck. And so all he was doing was looking at in and out. It doesn't matter what was doing the sensing. What mattered is what the user sensed it to be, right? Mm-hmm. As long as Toto doesn't pull the curtain back to reveal the wizard to be a fraud, the wizard is real.
Yeah.
Right? And it's the gesture, as long as I believe the gesture's there and it behaves consistently with my expectations, then it's real. And you work in the fact that your arm's lazy. If you shook it up here, it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Right? You had to shake it there, but it just turns out that people shook it there. So, and that's stuff that I'd even forgotten about.
Right.
And then you go back, and that's why it's so important, why I love video, is that we used to video all along from the beginning. It's because I didn't want to lose this stuff because you know, as I go on, the stuff I just discovered is brand new. I go back and look at videos and say, that idea was there, I talked about it there, but I didn't know it was important.
Right.
And therefore, I discounted it.
I mean, and that phone, actually, I remember when the first launch had the you shake to undo, right?
Yeah. But,
and anyway, I mean, were we upset last night? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, so our favorite pastime seems to be just reviewing the past, right? And the funny thing is, I look at those videos and just like, what you just talked about with the puck shaking gesture. I mean, we were delighted to watch that, and it could be that we got into a depression about how can we have an advance as much. I don't know. I always get re-inspired. Maybe,
I wasn't depressed. Here's why. So I'm an idiot. No. It's really, I love being stupid because it keeps you honest and you realize don't believe your own nonsense. Right? Just have it. Always assume that what you're saying that appears to be this strong thing. It's a hypothesis. It's not a fact. Right? So here's the example. So I wrote this book on sketching. How to all this tool about sketching and stuff like that. And I come from music where I know the difference between synthesis and sampling. And I went through that whole period, and I realized that my collection, for example, those videos, for example, that is sketching and rapid prototyping, but it's instead of synthesizing them, it's sampling. Right?
Right.
And so so those are our prototypes. So what we were doing last night is we were rapid prototyping. We were using history and curating through history things that were relevant to what we're thinking about today that at the time weren't important to me because they weren't relevant to the problems that were in my face right then. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking at this stuff. And so this is the thing. Marcel Proust has this great line. The only true voyage of discovery is not to go to different places, but to see through different eyes. The fact is that if you keep yourself stimulated and you have people around who push you to change the optics, I can look at exactly the same thing, even if I wrote it or was involved in it, and it's still new.
Right.
And because I'm seeing it through different eyes in the Proustian sense. And that's why eBay, for me, is at least as important in terms of rapid prototyping as all of the 3D printers in the world put together. And the best example, I don't have it right now, but I almost brought it this week, but the batteries were dead. But my watch, you've seen me before, it's on my YouTube channel if anyone wants to see it, but it's the Casio AT550. It had a capacitive touchscreen on it, with character recognition. So the calculator version, you can just write the characters one on top of another, so you don't need a keyboard. That means you could enter the numbers eyes free. You could write down a phone number with your eyes in the phone book. Remember phone books? Mm-hmm. And write them down without looking, without having to come back and forth. Same thing. It had not the AT550, but a different version of it, which I also have, that was a phone number. So you could put in names and look up people's phone numbers. Okay, character recognition on a capacitive touchscreen on a wristwatch, thin, beautiful, $99.95 in 1984. The same year Mark Zuckerberg was born, the same year the Macintosh came out. Now, tell me why we should be impressed today. But the thing about it is, most people don't recognize that. Every time with these smart watches, the thing that's interesting about it is it's a heads up, you can touch right.
Yeah.
And I can tweet or write or text like that without, you know, if you're telling me your phone number, I can write it down without being rude. It changes the social graces. I'm just saying it's right there. You can buy one on eBay. And even if it's $1,000 instead of $100 now, what does it cost you in terms of overall time to build that experience? Way more than $1,000. Mm-hmm. Go buy it.
And that's the other thing he brought over was the very first other remote control for a TV that he just proudly purchased on eBay and brought it over, and we were this big wooden box.
That was the radio. That was the 39 Philco radio. I brought in the world's first wireless TV remote control, and I brought in the world's first wireless radio remote control. And these things are just stunningly beautiful. But I love collecting these things because you can see them in a historical context. You can realize it's not just about the box. It's not just about them and the TV. It tells you that transaction cost is critical. Here's the thing I learned in doing the study on remote controls. It's staggering, right? You got a product. It's price sensitive, really, really competitive. We can't add any more cost to this. Cost of goods are really, really important and stuff like that. So some joker comes on and says, okay, I'm going to add a whole bunch of redundant controls. Things are already there. You've already paid for it. They're already delivered. They already work perfectly. I'm going to add another volume control. I'm going to add another channel changer. I'm going to add another on-off switch. And by the way, I'm going to have it in a separate box. And you're going to say, why would you add that? It's going to cost more money. Well, because it's not about the control. It's about not having to get out of your chair. In fact, the first TV remote control was called Lazy Boy. I forget the last part, but I think maybe it was the Lazy Boy. Controller. That was in 1950, if I remember correctly. And it actually really wasn't the first, but it's claimed to be the first. But the thing that's fascinating about that is, when you get into the mid-50s with remote controls, the remote control, the costs of that, was 30% of the cost of the television. It had nothing to do with the image. It just had to do that you were eating chips and beer and didn't want to get out of your chair. It's a fascinating thing, right? And so how would that have come up in any normal engineering decision would never have come up with that was important. And so looking through that, but this earlier one on the radio, the 1939 one, this was just amazing because telephone dials were starting to be ubiquitous, the rotary dial. Yeah. It was a phone dial and you dialed in the station and you used the dial to control the volume. You used another button to mode thing to actually control. If you dialed one, it was going to make it louder for as long as you held down the button. It was hysterical because it's got these references. The 1955 first wireless remote control for the TV was shaped like a Flash Gordon ray gun in the same colors as a Flash Gordon toy, and it was called the Flashmatic. It was a Zenith. And so there's all these cultural references, and it just happened that 1953 is when Flash Gordon went on television. So it was this big show. So they actually tied into that through the branding and stuff and the colors and the name. And then you realize that we're not just designing. When we design, it's not just about the device. It's not even about the immediate experience of saving you getting off your butt to go change a TV. It's got to do fitting in with the content of the TV. It's got to do with the whole branding and the shape of the experience and the cultural references at the time. And those things are, every single one of those things have analogies and relevance to today. And so how do you sample that if you build a prototype? Because you're, right? And that's the part, 50% of our prototyping should be looking at the history and the other half. It's always been that case in research. That recherche means the scholarship part of research. And it's always been part of research. But we've fallen into the trap in the last 50 years in the information and digital space where we think it's all about invention, making it new. And then if you can't do that, you're not a genius.
Right.
And if somebody else tells you that's been done before, this was the Media Lab's biggest flaw. They had to rename and rebrand everything as if nothing had happened before so they could get sponsor money. That's my pessimist stake of that. But the point was is that they never acknowledged the sources. My sense is that I have way more respect for Keith Richards when he does play a Chuck Berry lick because now he's doing it, right? And it should be fundamental. We've got to change that. Yeah. And but the other part is, and this is the part that's really critical, from what Jeff was saying is about this we've got to take all these other things into consideration. So we're not Renaissance men, they're women. The Renaissance is over in terms of the individual, but not in terms of the team. So I have this new rule.
It's like we've run out of single-threaded performance now for each person.
Yeah. So I have this new rule. This is the hard one. I think this is a really important lesson for Microsoft, but for anybody working in this space. And this is my HR rule. And here it is. The person that I am most qualified to hire is the last person I should hire. Because the person I'm most qualified to hire is someone whose skills overlap with mine, and therefore I'm really well qualified to evaluate their skills, assuming I'm any good at what I do. Mm-hmm. And the person I need the most is the person who is strongest in all the things I really suck at. And the dirty little secret of highly accomplished people, of which Microsoft is full of, is in order to be highly accomplished, no matter how diverse you appear to be, is the things that you've neglected that normal people would just take for granted that you're incompetent at. And I include myself in that. And now the people that scare me are the ones who think their brilliance spans the full 360. The people I want to work with are the ones that know where their competence is and then find people with complementary skills. And so when I look at any problem, and this is the biggest design challenge. Design challenge number one is, what's the space of the problem set we have to deal with? And then what are the skill sets that are required? And then I've got this part covered, so now, unless I need redundancy, the first thing I do is I start filling in the blanks. And after I got the filled in, I can think about then stacking the deck to have a bit more bench strength. And then, because the same thing's true with people as it is with technologies, everyone's best for something or worst for something else. And what you want is make sure you've got the space covered. What is the space? And then you have to figure out what the culture is, the working culture. And then you can start to work at the product. And if you've done those first two well, designed those are your first two design things. Oh, then the processors, the second one, right? Then the product almost pops out. And every product has different problems, therefore it needs a different culture. So we've got to think about how do we adapt our working structure and our teams so that they fit the problem and they're tailored for the problem.
Yeah.
And what are the skill sets? And maybe it's still a triad, but maybe the triads are slightly different now going forward than they have been in the past.